Good afternoon or good morning. This is Deanna and welcome to Spingola and Friends. It is Monday, July 28th, 2014. This is, as I said, Deanna. This weekly radio program is not sponsored by anyone and therefore is for people who really can handle the truth. I do recommend that you visit my website, spingola.com. And I hate to plug myself. I feel very uncomfortable doing this, but I'm going to do it. I just received my supply of book 3, both hardcover and paperback. It is the third book in the Ruling Elite series. Its title is The Ruling Elite: Death, Destruction, and Domination. I also wish to call your attention to the timeline of book 2 and 3, which is a work in progress. It is on my website at spingola.com. If you order books from me, I pay the shipping on all books within the country. The books are also available at Amazon, including the Kindle versions. I would love to have you visit the website of a very dear person who has created and maintains the website, spingolaspeaks.wordpress.com. We will be taking questions and comments from the listeners via my email, comment@spingola.com, or from the chat room, spingola.chatango.com. My guest today is Rodney Martin. He is the director of Worldview Foundations. His website is wvfoundations.org, and he has the distinction of being the very, very, very first guest on my network, my blog talk program. Anyway, Rodney, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I was 900 on Spingola Speaks, and I'm number one here. I think I like being number one.
I will always remember you as my 900th guest because it was you were so compassionate and considerate, because that was the first program that I did after the axe fell at RBN, and you just helped me through it. When I didn't anticipate and didn't mean to shed a tear or two, but I did, and thank you for wiping them up, you know, virtually. I mean, it was just, I will always be grateful to you for being so kind.
Well, you know, our audience becomes our family. You know, you and I both have a really dedicated audience, and so, you know, I think they were as emotional as I was, that day, and so for us to, you know, step up and support one another, I think that's important. And I think there was a time when I was doing a show when my wife took ill. I think I got a little emotional too, and I got inundated by callers that particular day. So I was happy to return the favor to you.
Exactly.
Given the fact that you gave me a microphone, you know, on very politically incorrect and controversial subjects for about, 2 years, Deanna? I mean, geez.
I think so. I'll have to check back into my archive. See, I have an archive of every single, well, I don't have the audio file, but I have a record of every program that I've ever done. And I believe that you are I have had you on my program more than any other guest. Clint Richardson used to have that distinction, but I believe that you have bypassed him. And, of course, he has a program on RBN at 7 p.m. Central Time. But anyway, I just enjoy having you on the program. I enjoy talking with you about things. And you're very you educate the audience so well, and I really appreciate that.
I have fun doing what I do, even when, you know, I'm talking to people we may not agree. I think it's important that we have civil discussions, even if we don't agree on all the particulars. You know, that's should be the whole focus of the truth movement. And unfortunately, we've seen with situations involving you and another good friend that you and I were talking about just before we went on the air, and some others, you know, that's not been the case, unfortunately. We've seen situations where, I'll use the word charlatans, have, you know, for personal reasons, have attacked people for daring to disagree in this, you know, the battle for truth. And you know, that's unfortunate. But I don't think that's going to change.
Oh, I don't anticipate that anytime soon. People are always going to be willing and able and take a lot of effort to silence us or to vilify us so that other people won't listen.
Mm. Well, I have a lot of notes this morning, and so but I'm glad we have 2 hours and we don't have all of those. You don't have commercials on this.
No, on this one, it's commercial free. The only commercial that people are going to hear is the one that I gave on my books. And I like I said, I don't feel comfortable promoting myself. It's just, I don't know. Whatever.
Well, you know, we talked about, you know, fact versus, you know, fiction. And I think there's been, you know, it's bad enough that we have court historians, you know, running around twisting the narrative. And I think in the last few years we've even had a lot of, whitewashing. We've had graves erased, Hitler's parents' graves erased, Rudolf Hess's graves erased. Then we had articles in German media saying, oh, by the way, the National Socialists weren't responsible for the, you know, for the Volkswagen and the Autobahns. I mean, it's been absolutely, absolutely incredible. But then we have additionally conflicting statements that, you know, the National Socialists weren't even, you know, they weren't this Volksgemeinschaft, that they, you know, that it was just, wasn't much different than a multicultural kumbaya type of situation. And there's just, I think that's by design in a lot of cases. There's a lot of times where people will like, they'll like certain elements of something out of the past, whether it's the Roman Empire or the National Socialist, the Third Reich, or even Weimar, for peace sake. I mean, there's Weimar fan sites, for peace sake. But then they'll omit, or they'll try to conform it to meet, you know, the modern. It's like trying to, I've often used the analogy, you can't analyze history through today's eyes. And, you know, that's why I always rely on original sources. I mean, it's the thing about the Third Reich is they left us so much. You can actually go in and look at the original sources. You can look at the warts. You can look at the good. You can look at the stuff that you don't agree with. But I think it's important as a historian that we take, you know, you take it all. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, we have several topics to talk about. And I think, Deanna, let's take the first one. You shared an email from an author, and I think we talked about this before, Himmler at Posen. We have a list of items here that we're going to talk about. Himmler at Posen said that, you know, there was this gathering at Posen, and which, you know, they've said often enough that, you know, Himmler said he was going to exterminate the Jews, and this was a noble task, blah, 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 blah. And we've talked about this on other shows. You know, and the fact of the matter is, there have been the most common canard that Himmler said exterminate. This is almost like deportation or relocation to the east. And I think that it is important to note that I'm monitoring the chat too, by the way. And if the questions pop up, I'll try to incorporate those.
Right. Yes.
Himmler was conveniently, you know, died. They say he committed suicide in Nuremberg in British custody, but the manner in which, you know, he was photographed in a British Army uniform with a blanket wrapped around his lower torso, I'm suspicious. And his daughter, who is still alive, in what limited statement she has given, does not believe the official account of his death. And upon a lot of review, I don't believe that he died in the manner in which the court historians record his death. But he is, you know, he was conveniently not asked about Posen, and I concur with a lot of the revisionist statements. And if you look at the text and you listen to some of the weird, very strange recordings of Posen, I believe that the translation and the is not accurate. Because there's just it's very, very easy to fudge his statements. Plus, if you look at the audience, I think, you know, what really needs to be looked at beyond just the translation error, look at who was present at that speech. It wasn't just SS. There was also high and mid-level Wehrmacht there as well as some governmental ministerials. There was it was almost like a general type of meeting amongst people that didn't ordinarily mingle with one another. It's not a secret that the SS and the Wehrmacht did not necessarily get along, with the exception of the Waffen-SS, which was nominally under the command of the Wehrmacht. But the audience at Posen was not one that would normally get along and would mingle around. And also, there's just not a lot of authentication of that Posen speech. So I just don't think you can take the Posen speech on its face value. And interestingly, it's not widely used. If you go around, it's not widely used as a smoking gun, and I think for good reason it's not widely used for smoking gun. I think if you were to really put it through scientific analysis, you would find that, one, the argument with the translation, we would win that argument, as well as doctored, as well as the actual audio being doctored. Let's understand that the Allies had tremendous resource, had all of the resources of Hollywood, deployed in 1943 and 1944 in the field.
Right.
Whereas the Germans were pulling people from their, what you would say, propaganda, news and information. They were being, transferred to frontline service because the war was turning. So, they had essentially was not their, was the furthest thing from their mind. They were focused on winning the war, whereas the Allies was churning out this incredible web of lies, deceit, and false propaganda. Posen, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because we have in prior shows, there's a lot of work out there dealing with Posen. And it's just not the fact that it is not widely used as a smoking gun, I think, speaks more for it being discredited and not having any credibility than spending a lot of time and rehashing it. And I'm not seeing any real questions about Posen in the chat room. It looks like there's more, goo-boo and gossip in the chat room about other stuff.
Important stuff.
Yeah. So anyway, unless you have anything more about Posen, I just don't think it's credible. I don't think Posen is credible. No one can make the case that the Posen speech is credible or a smoking gun. The translation issue alone, I think, discredits Posen's speech.
Absolutely. But they use that. Some people will use that and with the word exterminate as if it were the key document. And as you said, if they actually did have any key documents, they certainly would have been used. And in fact, most of those documents they used at Nuremberg were so insignificant that if they had something, they would have used it.
Well, it's the same thing. In the same documents, where there were German documents talking about resettlement and relocation to the east, they said, well, that actually meant extermination, when at the same time, in these same documents, you'll find that there was actually equipment and materials being sent to the east to resettle these Jews as well. There was hard lines. There was kitchen equipment. There's all sorts of equipment to set up, to resettle them. So if you're going to send Jews to the east to exterminate them, you don't send equipment and materials to resettle them in, these camps as well. You just send them, and that's the end of it. So sure. even that argument is baseless as well.
Sure.
Were they resettled to for labor? Yes. And isn't that a pity that Jews were required to work for a change?
Exactly.
That's just an absolute crime. It reminds me of the welfare queen that testified in Congress that requiring her to work for her welfare is a violation of her human rights. It's just incredible. And that's a true story because I saw that testimony.
Sure. Now I just looked in the at Blog Talk Radio at the And we do have two callers. I think maybe, I don't know, maybe one of them is you.
I'm one of them. No, you actually Skyped me in, so I wouldn't be
okay.
a caller.
Okay. We do have two callers.
Go ahead.
Okay. 304 is, I got to press something. Okay, 304, you had a question, 304? Okay. 304?
You might have to unmute the call.
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
304? Yoo-hoo! Okay, I don't know. He's just breathing.
Oh, he might be just listening.
Okay, he might be just listening. Okay, I'm going to mute 304 again. Okay, I don't hear him breathing anymore. And let's go to 412. 412, do you have a question or comment? Nope. I guess. Okay, I heard myself, but all righty. I guess so. Maybe these were just people who were listening in or something, but okay, so we will proceed.
Okay. Now, there is something else that I don't think we need to cover any more about Pope Posen unless somebody calls in and wants to talk about that. But you had another show, I think, on one of your network a week or two ago, and there was a statement made that I do want to respond. There was a couple of statements made that I want to respond to, and I'm not going to get this into any sort of debate, but this is one of these philosophical and historical differences. But there was a statement made that President von Hindenburg was blackmailed into the appointment of Hitler's chancellor in January the 30th, 1933. And I've titled this, you know, the Hitler-appointed chancellor, President von Hindenburg, blackmail or Weimar politics. And this is something I want to talk about for a little bit because
sure.
I find that an interesting statement because it just doesn't appear to meet the facts. And this goes, and I believe the premise was that President von Hindenburg was a tax cheat. He wasn't paying taxes on his Neudeck estate, and the National Socialist had found out about it and was holding this over his head. And, you know, and somebody, you know, they had gone to him and said, unless you appoint Hitler, this was the premise, then we're going to make this public. And so as a result, he appointed Hitler chancellor. If I remember correctly, listening to that show, that was the premise. And so as a result, von Hindenburg appointed Hitler chancellor to avoid any sort of embarrassment of being exposed as a tax cheat on his Neudeck estate. Let's back up and talk about Neudeck. Neudeck was originally von Hindenburg's family estate from years back, and it had been lost. Prussian Junkers put together a pool of money and repurchased that for him and presented it to him not too terribly long. I think maybe 5 or 10 years. It was in the 20s, if I remember correctly, and presented that to him as a gift. Keep in mind, President von Hindenburg, Field Marshal von Hindenburg, was an icon. He was one of those persons that even if he was some sort of tax cheat, the German public would not have cared. Weimar was held in such utter, and by the way, Adolf Hitler, most recently and going back 20 years, has been called a tax cheat as well. But Weimar was held in such utter disdain by the German populace that even if that was true, which it was not, the public, he was held on such a high pedestal that the population wouldn't have cared. But that estate was, money was pooled by some Prussian Junkers. Keep in mind, von Hindenburg had come from a Prussian aristocratic family. President von Hindenburg was in the hall as a young lieutenant at the Hall of Versailles when Germany was unified in 1871. He was there. I mean, this is a man whose service transcended. You know, he was there at the foundation of the Reich Then he served through the Weimar period, through the imperial period. He had retired, was called out of retirement, was the hero of Tannenberg. He was, you know, he had the distinction of being the first elected, popularly elected president in German history. He was just one of those persons that transcended. But this concept that somehow he was a tax cheat, and they had this dirt on him, and that was the reason, the only reason why he was appointed, Hitler was appointed chancellor. There's just no basis in fact in that. And let's just go back a little bit. His house was purchased by Prussian Junkers. That was common knowledge, and that was common knowledge throughout Germany. The German media covered that. You can go back and find German newspaper coverage. That was covered. As a matter of fact, there was some sort of ceremony, you can find it in the German media, where they actually presented him his house, his estate, this Neudeck estate. It's gone now. It was burned. It was used by a Soviet headquarters after the war. It had mysteriously burned down, and there's only thing that's left of it is the writing stables today. But in any event, let's go back. We did a show, Deanna, on your, I believe on Spengola Speaks, where we went through the elections of the NSDAP from, I think, 1923 was the first year that the NSDAP contested elections. But remember, we talked about that in July 1932, under the Weimar Constitution, the NSDAP received an outright majority and Hitler should have been appointed.
Absolutely. It was legal. Totally. Right. Completely.
So, if, you know, and Hindenburg said no, because keep in mind, there was tension. There was tension between von Hindenburg and Hitler. Originally, Hindenburg just did not like, they did not get along, and Hitler had attested to that in many conversations. He would say, the old gentleman just did not take a liking to me initially. I mean, I'm paraphrasing.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody in the chat room is saying Hitler had syphilis.
No, he didn't.
And committed incest, etc. You know, this person really is taking trolling to a whole new level.
Well,
if you want me to address that, I will. But
that is something that was produced by a lot of the official version, the official history of Adolf Hitler was created by the CIA, and I cover that in my book. It's absolutely ridiculous. He didn't go to Argentina. He didn't go to the moon. He's dead, okay? And no. That nonsense about him being a pedophile and committing incest is absolutely ridiculous.
But anyway, if with Hitler having the majority, the NSDAP having a majority in July 1932, if they were going to use something on von Hindenburg, there would have been the prime time to use it right then and there. And the fact that von Hindenburg, even at his advanced age, you know, we did a show and we talked about von Hindenburg as well. Von Hindenburg, even at his advanced age, was very sharp and very was very alert. He was stuck to his guns. What happened?
Just a quick comment.
Sure.
What the person in the chat room was saying was that they use everything to discredit the NSDAP, and then he goes on to say some of the things. He was not saying that he believed this. So sometimes when we read it, one comment, and think, oh, that stupid man, what's he saying? But then we have to read what he said before. So anyway, okay.
Okay, well, I apologize then.
Well, I knew we had astute listeners, and I thought, no, this doesn't sound like him. So anyway.
Yeah, well, I glanced up and seen this, and I thought, where does this come in? Let me say, you ought to see some of the emails I get about this stuff, and it gets to be a little old after.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Especially now.
Absolutely.
20 years ago, let me digress a little bit, this tax cheat stuff particularly, and this is why I'm responding to this. This tax cheat stuff came out on Hitler, and when you actually get in, when you get into what they were talking, they accused Hitler of being a tax cheat, much like this thing came out about von Hindenburg being blackmailed because he wasn't paying taxes on Neudeck. When you actually got into what they were, and now today, just recently, the same accusation against Hitler. They've dusted off the same accusation and they republished it in the British media. What they're accusing Hitler is saying he didn't pay taxes on all his income, and what they were basically saying is he should have paid taxes on basically travel expenses, such as when the party flew him.
Oh.
You know, remember when he became famous as being the first politician during the presidential campaign in 1932 for flying, you know, from German city to German city to German city?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were making the case that that was basically private use of that airplane, and that should have been used. Weimar basically billed him as that was a private use of an airplane, and he contested it. Basically, Adolf Hitler contested Weimar taxing authorities' assessments, just like anybody else would. Just like anybody. They basically were using the tax authority, much like what we see with the IRS. Weimar used the Weimar tax authority to harass Hitler and other NSDAP officials as a weapon. And they basically said that, you know, party business, where the party would pay for him to fly on an airplane or would pay for party officials, that was income and he had to pay personal taxes on it. And he would contest those. And in each and every case, he won, which means the Weimar tax, what we would, in our version of tax court, he would go into a tribunal and would win. They would say, yes, Herr Hitler, we've reviewed this. You are correct. That is not taxable. But yet this Jewish media today is saying, well, he must have bullied and intimidated, you know, the taxing tribunal under Weimar for them to dismiss those assessments. But and so when I see this garbage where you have people today going back, these court historians, and saying Adolf Hitler was a tax cheat, when all he did was contest the assessment of income on basically business, you know, reimbursements or business expenses, which everybody does, and it's legal. You know, it's just silly, because what they're trying to paint him is, you know, we've already seen all of this nonsense, like the gentleman who I just apologized to. They paint all of this garbage. You know, he wasn't a real German. You know, he was an Austrian. Well, Austrians are what? They're Germans.
They're Germans.
He wasn't that. And then, you know, he was a coward. They questioned his war record. He was a tax cheat. All of this garbage, and now we see this, you know, this is why this particular comment that, you know, von Hindenburg, he got his appointment as chancellor because they were blackmailing von Hindenburg. So let's fast forward to January of 1933. You know, they had called that election in July 1932, and it didn't work. The NSDAP got even stronger. And there was a period where Hitler was offered the vice chancellorship, and Hitler said no. Hitler had this position in Weimar that things were trending their way. And there was two parties that were getting stronger. And we had talked about this on the prior show. And that was the communists, which Hindenburg absolutely hated. And there was the National Socialists. And we had talked about on the prior show that Hindenburg's own conservative base supported the National Socialists, because workers who traditionally would support the Social Democrats, who Hindenburg didn't like, by the way, and he hated the communists, workers, the working class who supported the communists, were peeling away from the communists and Social Democrats and were supporting the National Socialists, who were fervent German nationalists. But, you know, also they had this commitment to social programs and such, and Hindenburg's own conservative base like that, and there was this belief, you know what, we can work with these people, and they were influencing Hindenburg. You know what, there's only two parties that are trending: the old system under Weimar, where you have a political party for each group, the Catholic Center Party for the Catholics, the Social Democrats for the labor unions. All of that is collapsing. What you're seeing now is the emergence of single party for all groups and classes, and that's being divided into two, the communists and the National Socialists. We better pick a side. And that's why I've subtitled this, Deanna, The Appointment of Hitler. Was it blackmail or was it Weimar politics? It was clearly Weimar politics. And two things happened in the run-up to January 1933. You had these massive street fights between the communists and the National Socialists. because the communists were sensing, you know, they were on the rise too. And the communists, the court historians and the media paints the National Socialists as the bullies and the, you know how they're painted. When in fact, it was the National Socialists, it was the SA that protected the everyday German so the, you know, the elderly lady could go to the market and do what little shopping they could do under that horrific Weimar economy. We're going to talk about the economy as well.
Yeah.
And so it was the SA. And there are actually, you can go into these old archives and see German Weimar police reports saying, you know, hey, it was, you know, in some respects it was the SA that were keeping the streets, you know, somewhat orderly in some of the, you know, rougher districts of Berlin orderly. We can talk about why Horst Wessel was killed. He was killed in one of the rougher areas of Berlin. But anyway, it was bad. And so you had Hindenburg sitting as president. He'd already said no in July 1932. You had this violence in the streets, and he had his own conservative base lobbying him, let's work with the National Socialists. They're drawing people from the Social Democrats, from the communists, the old political structure where you have parties for each group is dissolving, and pretty soon it's going to be, we're going to have to pick a side, let's pick a side. And so you have this continuing lobbying. There wasn't any black mail. Nobody went to von Hindenburg and said, oh, you haven't been paying the tax man on Neudeck. I mean, they, you know, let's talk about something here. The German media, the Weimar media, was every bit as scuzzy as the Jew media, because it was Jew media, as the American media is today. They reported on Hitler's relationship with his niece. That was in the Weimar media. Don't you? I mean, they reported some very nasty things about the internal dynamics in the SA. They reported some very, and they made stuff up. If there was this dynamic about von Hindenburg, it would have been reported. It would have been reported that there was an issue. It would have been reported, when it was revealed. If he, you know, it was reported when the estate was purchased for him and presented to him. And if there was an issue about the president being a tax cheat, the Jew media, which did not like the fact that he was an arch conservative, that he was basically pro-monarchist. Von Hindenburg probably, had he had his had his ultimate way, he would have brought the Kaiser back, that would have come out. So there wasn't any blackmail of President von Hindenburg, and even if they did, somebody would have come to him and tried to blackmail him. I think it's safe to assume what his response would have been, because we know that he was rather a feisty and strong-willed old Prussian field marshal.
Sure.
And that speaks to my final comment. I don't think that given his character, and one, there are some books. He did write a book about his life, and you can get an insight into his character. I think it's not credible to think that Field Marshal von Hindenburg was a tax cheat by any means. Let's remember when the Enabling Act was presented to him, he could have signed it, and he refused unless the Reichstag voted on it. So I think we need to keep some of these things in mind. But I just had to remove a kitty cat from the desk. I would have had a toppled mic. I think we've addressed that topic. I think it was purely Weimar politics. Now, is there a smoking gun? No, but there's nothing in the German media. You can go back into old German archive. newspapers. There's nothing about von Hindenburg being a tax cheat. Certainly people are free to float theories. There is credibility to the theory that the conservatives presented the concept of von Hindenburg appoint Hitler chancellor because we will be able to influence him. That is true because people survived the war and wrote after the fact, and they testified to the fact that they met with von Hindenburg, and that was the case they made to persuade him to appoint him, and this included von Hindenburg's own son, Oscar, who was quite close to his father, that was the case that they made, and it had primarily to do with the fact that the two parties were on the rise were the NSDAP and the KPD, which was the communists, and they had to pick a side. So this was purely Weimar politics, and they had to make the case to von Hindenburg that he had to face political reality, that he couldn't let his dislike of Hitler prevent him from ignoring the political realities any longer.
Absolutely. And the people supported the NSDAP, and they supported the policies. And we've had a lot of programs on the policies, and gosh, those policies are very they would do well here.
Well, let's understand that von Hindenburg then grew to actually support, and they didn't become close friends, but von Hindenburg grew to support Hitler. Now let's from January 1933 to August of 1934, as Hindenburg died in August of 1934, they worked together as the Reich president and the Reich chancellor.
Right.
And let's understand that von Hindenburg did not veto out of hand the Enabling Act when the Reichstag was burned and down by the communists. Von Hindenburg himself understood that the Reichstag was burned down by communists. He supported the National Socialist response to it. He also supported Hitler's response to the attempted Röhm plot as well. He actually sent a message to Hitler congratulating him on his response and swift and decisive actions. And that has largely gone, when people talk about Operation Hummingbird, which was the code name for Hitler's response to the putting down the Röhm, attempted Röhm coup, people don't like to bring up the fact that President von Hindenburg was supportive of Hitler's actions that night in June of 1934. Hitler was one of the last people to visit von Hindenburg when he was in a sickbed dying from cancer. And contrary to popular myth, von Hindenburg was not senile and feeble. He died of cancer. If I remember correctly, it was intestinal cancer that he died of. And he, in his very last days, he did become somewhat, because cancer does do that. And in those days, they didn't have all of the, the medical response. And it's probably a good thing, because today it's the treatment that kills you and not the bug itself.
Absolutely.
So I think it's important to note that once they worked together, they actually had a professional rapport that was very they had mutual respect, and Hitler always held him in high regard. In Hitler's official office, he always had a bust of President von Hindenburg and always referred to him as the old gentleman in very high regard.
Right. Absolutely.
Oh.
Yep. And that Enabling Act, the law was not something that he just created. That was something that had been used several times before.
It wasn't anything that
big thing. People voted for it. The people in the Reichstag voted for it. It wasn't.
Well, the NSDAP voted for it. The Catholic Center Party voted for it, and a few Social Democrats voted for it.
Right.
So not all of the Social Democrats, they were by far the opposition, voted against it. But if I remember correctly, 5 or 10 Social Democrats voted for it. But all of the members of the Catholic Center Party voted for it, as well as the NSDAP. They got 2/3. The NSDAP voted for it. They obtained the 2/3 necessary
for that type of legislation. And it's interesting to note, when I talked about the required two-thirds, the NSDAP followed the constitutional process required.
Okay. Are you there?
Do we have any call? Okay. Yeah, I'm here. Do we have any callers? Or
when there's any kind of quiet, I think, oh my gosh, I've lost.
No, I'm here. No, I just paused. I said, do we have any callers?
No, I just checked, and we don't. Some people are having some trouble staying loaded on Blog Talk. I had that trouble before, and I used a different browser. So when people do have trouble staying tuned into Blog Talk, try a different browser. I hate to use Internet Explorer, but that's the one that seems to work rather than Opera. I usually use Opera for a lot of things, but Firefox is pretty good.
Yeah, that's what I use.
Yeah.
That's what I use. Another question I wanted to respond to is, there was a statement that said, look at it. Why were all these Jews in the Third Reich? Well, there's a couple of answers. You know, my first answer would be, it just goes to show you that there wasn't any policy of exterminating Jews.
Right. There were a lot of them there, and there yeah. were a lot of them after the war all over Europe, and many of them had moved over to New York City and Miami Beach. Well,
Hollywood.
Hollywood. And there were more of them after the war than before. You just have to do the numbers, people.
Yeah. Well, when someone says that question, talk about, look at the Jews in Germany, look at the Jews in the German military. And there's a larger question. I want to divide this up, Deanna. I want to talk about the Jews in Germany. I don't want to talk about, and I think we have 20 minutes left in the first hours. I want to talk about this concept of, the Third Reich, its racial policies and the demographics of the German military. I'll do that in the second hour. But I want to talk about the question, somebody talked about, well, look at all the Jews and the Third Reich. Why were they there? Well, I want to point people to the Nuremberg Laws. And this also dispels the biggest myth. Well, the National Socialist government was just a dictatorship, a totalitarian regime, and they just did things off the cuff, and that's absolutely false, because they went through the legislative process. A significant number of members of the NSDAP, they were lawyers, they were doctors, and a lot of their policies that they developed had been in the works. And we'll cover this in the second hour. Were formulated on works of thinkers going back to the 1890s. Doctors and anthropologists and such that had been writing since the 1890s and early 1900s. That with the coming to power of the National Socialists, they had finally had a government that would implement their policies. But with regard to the Jews in Germany, well, there was never a policy to exterminate Jews in Germany. And this I'm going to touch real briefly, because one of the statements that made was that, Germany was basically, the premise was Germany was quasi-multicultural type and was mixed-race state, but that's false. We're going to deal with that in the next hour. But you got to look at the Nuremberg Laws, And the process by which Germany implemented legislation from the time they came to power in 1933. If you look at the Weimar period, let me back up a little bit. If you look at the imperial period, and then you look at what happened under the Weimar period, the National Socialists moved very quickly to correct what Weimar was trying to implement. Certainly, Weimar attempted to create a multicultural,
absolutely
mixed race United States of America of 2014 in 1919 to 1933.
And I recall the wonderful information that you gave to us about the Weimar Republic. That was absolutely excellent and bears repeating sometime in the future.
Yeah, the Weimar, and we can go back and do some another show on, because like I said, there's Weimar fanside, and there is this attempt to rehabilitate Weimar. There's books being churned out, Weimar, a culture law. There's a lot of that, which is fascinating. But there was, Weimar was that, and this is where I disagree with one of your prior guests. It wasn't the Third Reich that was, you know, the Germans of the Third Reich that was mixed, or the Germans that were mixed race or was seeking to be multicultural. Were Germans tolerant people? Yes. But what the Third Reich did was establish and firmly establish an ethno-state that was in place prior to Weimar, but it was much more on firmer footing. It was, and we can talk, like I say, I'm going to talk about the Nuremberg laws, because this addresses what, this addresses the issue, well, what about the Jews of Germany? They must not have, you know, it kind of undermines the concept of the Germans, you know, being, you know, racially based, or the National Socialists being racially based. And I can't remember the exact statements that were made, but what was implied was that there was this shift in paradigm, and that the National Socialists evolved, if I remember correctly, when in fact they actually, as they progressed, tightened that up. And I mean, one example I can make is that in Hitler's last will and testament, you know, not only did he appoint a successor government, but he commanded Germans to basically make sure they remain true to the 1935 Nuremberg laws, race laws, because there was this underlining, this issue of this concern that Germans would disappear, and they'd seen that in Weimar, and Hitler had spoken about it. But let's talk about the Nuremberg laws real briefly, and this will explain the Jews in Germany and why there were some Jews in Germany. And there's one particular sentence that will explain it. On my website, which was down for some time because we were doing some renovations to it, but it's back up, there's a reference library page. And on it, there's a 1935 NSDAP handbook. In the back of that handbook, on page 3214, you'll see, and they published this, a series of laws that were published that the NSDAP implemented between 1933 up until that period of time in 1936. Law for the Protection of German Blood and Honor. Now, that's pretty self-explanatory. The Reich Citizenship Law, and then first directive for the implementation of the Reich Citizenship Law, which is November 14, 1935. But what is interesting is in each and every case, if you go on the back of the Law for the Protection of German Blood and Honor, this was the Nuremberg, the famous Nuremberg Law, where it spelled out. This is the one where it basically kicked the Jews out. I'm simplifying there. Article 7, which was the very last article. The Führer and Reich Chancellor may grant exemption from the regulations of this directive. And that was the very last. That meant that, and previous to that, it granted the promulgating that law to Wilhelm Frick, the Minister of the Interior, and the Deputy Führer Rudolf Hess. In all of the Nuremberg laws, they were it was the Interior Minister and Rudolf Hess. And by the way, I'd love to do a show on Rudolf Hess. Because he actually had a tremendous, up until the time he left for England, exercised tremendous administrative authority in his role as Deputy Führer. We'll see here that it was him and the Interior Minister that promulgated the Nuremberg laws, but ultimately Hitler himself could grant exemptions. Mm-hmm. Now, how many exemptions did he grant? Let's talk about that. Very few, very few. You can go into the records. And for the most part, he granted them to spouses and to a couple of high-level officers. Let's somebody just suggested a show on Frick. That would be a good one as well. By the way, Frick, Wilhelm Frick's granddaughter lives in New York, by the way.
Ah.
I've spoken to her. And Stalin's granddaughter lives in Portland, Oregon. Just no Russian accent. But anyway, did he grant a lot of exemptions? There seems to be the impression that Germany was just festooned with all of these Jews, and the exemptions were few and far between. Now, General Heinrichsi was a general in the high command, very capable field commander. His wife was a Mischlinger. Hitler granted her an Aryan certificate. He was very fond of Heinrichsi. That was one exemption.
Mm-hmm.
That I can think of. I actually made a list not too terribly long ago, Deanna, and don't hold me to this, but I think I can count on both hands the number of exemptions he granted in accordance with Article 7. The rest of it went through Wilhelm Frick and Rudolf Hess up until 1941 when Hess left for England.
Right.
After Hess left for England, that role fell to Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring. He assumed that role of the co-role with Wilhelm Frick of promulgating the Nuremberg decrees. But there seems to be a perception among some, and some people will say that that Hitler was just, you know, churning out exemptions left and right. There wasn't the need for a lot of exemptions. If you look at the Nuremberg laws, and let me pull up, there was they defined who could stay, who was a Jew, and you know who was acceptable. Let's leave it that way. There was a test, and who was not, who was acceptable, and who was not. It's not that complicated, and I would encourage the listeners, and I'm not going to sit here and waste time on the air, you know, reading the Nuremberg laws because it's not relevant. But when somebody says that the National Socialist government in Germany was somehow multicultural or was festooned with Jews, its objective, let's understand what its primary objective was in January 1933, and it accomplished it. One, it wanted to remove the Jews, and we talk about the Jews, they defined it in the Nuremberg, from the positions of influence in the German government and the German culture, and that's, you can find on YouTube, it's translated, where Joseph Goebbels is talking about a German government for Germans, a German culture, German art. They did that, and there was a specific. They also removed Jews from the civil service, and that is also
because they had such influence in medicine at the university, in the theater. I mean, just throughout the culture, and much as we have here in America.
Right. Well, it's gotten worse in America. Now there was a comment, and the Nuremberg laws covered this. It somebody had made the comment that the Nuremberg laws were actually amended in 1935, later in 1935. And this, and we're going to, in the second hour, we'll talk about the influence of three individuals who influenced the National Socialist policy. But let's talk about a couple of sections. We have about 5 minutes before. But what were, you know, there was five primary sections. Section one was marriages between Jews and citizens of the German Reich or kindred blood were strictly forbidden, and this was at, and these were passed, by the way, at the party rally in 1935.
But let's mention too that these Nuremberg laws were acceptable to the Jews because the rabbis did not want intermarriage. They did not want the Jews to intermarry with Germans, and so this was very acceptable to them. They weren't fighting the Nuremberg law on that regard.
No, the laws that are on the books in the state that's called Israel and occupied Palestine, I will not give that place any legitimacy. But they are far more restrictive than the Nuremberg laws in terms of marriages and citizenship and race laws. So when people get on me, talk about me, because I've said, you know, these are pretty good in terms of if you want to preserve who and what you are, and people get mad at me and, you know, call me evil, wicked, blah, 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 blah. And we're going to talk about this in the second hour. Were the Nazis supremacists? No. Not at all, because we're going to talk about Jesse Owens, because an article came out recently about Jesse Owens, too. There's a good example there. No, they weren't supremacists at all. But then it goes on. It says proceedings for annulment may be initiated only by the public prosecutor. And it's important to know what the public prosecutor was back then. It's not what we consider today. Extramarital sexual intercourse between Jews and subjects of the state of Germany or related blood is forbidden. By the way, Israel implements that same policy.
Plus several more.
Yeah, plus many more. Jews will not be permitted to employ female citizens under the age of 45 of German kindred blood as domestic workers. And we all know what they were doing, Deanna, in Germany. Prior to this law, you'd have these old Jews hiring, you know, because the economy was bad, little 13-year-old German girls, and we know what was happening. Jews are forbidden to display the Reich or national flag or the national colors. On the other hand, they will be permitted to display the Jewish colors. They do that here in L.A., by the way. But those were the three primary elements, and they became effective on January 1st, 1936, but these were passed at the party rally in 1935. Now, a few months later, they were amended, and they included gypsies and Negroes. And we'll cover that in the second hour. I don't know if you take a break at the top of the hour or we just keep on going.
I'm not sure what the policy is yet, because being this is the first program.
Okay, well, some people on Blog Talk play music at the top of the hour for a couple of minutes, but if not, we can just keep on going.
Sure.
But I thought it was important to note the answer to that question. When somebody says, look at all the Jews in Germany, yes, there was Jews in Germany, but they were regulated under the Nuremberg laws. And for someone to say that and omit the Nuremberg laws is being just, you know, it's a little far-fetched, because the Nuremberg laws regulated Jews in the Greater German Reich. It's all there. The Germans passed a whole series of legislation beginning in March of 1933, beginning with the Jewish question when they kicked them out of the civil service. If full-blooded Jews were not allowed to serve in the Wehrmacht, they were not allowed to serve in the civil service. And Mischlinge were very, you know, the half-bloods were very, regulated.
Give a couple of reasons why. In 1933, international Jewry declared war on Germany. Economic warfare. And this was an alien body who had declared that Germany was an enemy. So, of course, Germany responded to protect itself.
Well, you know, it took them 2 years. Germany waited 2 years to respond. To respond to it, and I think that showed amazing restraint by Germany to wait 2 years when you have, and by all accounts, there's nobody who can disprove the fact that Jews always act as a state within a state. Let's look here really briefly. Here in Los Angeles, there have been three articles in the Los Angeles Jewish Journal highlighting three Jews with American citizenship that have been wounded or killed in the Israeli Defense Forces murdering Palestinians in Gaza.
Yeah.
Those are foreign. You know, they're serving in a foreign military while holding U.S. One of them went to West Hollywood High School. born in the United States, born in Los Angeles, and then immediately upon graduation goes to Israel, joins the Israeli army, and then gets killed, and we're, you know, and they're holding him up as some hero. So it's a fact that all through history, Jews have been a state within a state. Go back to 1933, Jews declare war on Germany, and Germany doesn't really react until 1935. They say, well, wait a minute, they've declared war on us. We have all these enemy aliens, and let's treat them as enemy aliens. Did not the United States treat the Japanese as enemy aliens after Pearl Harbor?
Indeed, and they also treated the Germans as aliens. In fact, they went down to South America and deported a lot of Germans from countries in South America and put them in prison camps here in this country. I covered that in my book.
Yeah, I mean, so it's, of course, you know, remember what Churchill's famous quote, he wasn't worried about history because he'd be writing it.
Exactly.
You know, it's just amazing. Don't get me started on Churchill.
No, but, we don't want to do that because that would take several weeks for us to cover all of his criminal activities.
Yeah, not to mention his decadent activities. But
yes, that would take two programs.
Isn't it amazing? Real brief commentary. You have a man that was so pathetic that his wife had to seek solace in the arms of other men. He smoked, he drank, he was nasty, he was absolutely, just absolutely nasty. And yet you have Hitler, who was an artist, who, you know, nobody cares about Churchill's paintings, by the way. Hitler, you know, never, I mean, he was obscene, Churchill was. Hitler would forbid drinking and smoking, he was a gentleman, and yet, who does history hold up as a great person, and who does history vilify? It's just absolutely incredible, and people, you know, just people just go for this.
Yes. People are so easily brainwashed, indoctrinated, and as you say, the victors write the history.
Yeah, well, I don't go for, you know, I just, you know, remember, we had to take books and look at them for, you know, diamonds in the cat box.
Right.
But no, I'm not telling some people their books are cat boxes.
I just love that saying of yours. Excuse me. I just love that saying of yours.
Well,
I mean,
in all fairness, it was my grandma saying it.
Yes, but it's such a clever thing to say.
Continue. Demographics of the German military. That is a good. It's good. But let's keep in mind. I just recently did a. Well, let me back up a little bit. If you're going to research and study and quote demographics of the German military, you can go and get the Bundesarchives. You can get the reports and regimental reports of the German Wehrmacht, you know, the Heer, the Luftwaffe, the Kriegsmarine, and the Waffen-SS. You can get those demographics. There is also an excellent book by David Stone called History, Hitler's Army, The Men, Machines, and Organization, 1939 to 1945, beautiful coffee table book. I sit it on my coffee table when I invite people from, you know, the church over just to make them uncomfortable. Just sit it right there. Sit it right there. And,
don't you love doing that?
And anyway, and just watch them kind of looking at it and waiting to see who's going to say something first. But anyway, so if you're going to talk about demographics, yes, okay. There, you know, you have two. You have the traditional Wehrmacht, which had been the Reichswehr under Weimar. What were there non-Germans that served and wore the uniform of Germany between 1939 and 1945? Yes, but actually more so between 1941 and 1945. And let me clarify that. First of all, if you're going to do and talk about and quote demographics of who served and fought for Germany, I would submit that you should look at that book, a few others, and look in the Bundesarchives, German archives, and really get an idea. Because what you're going to find is that in the regular Wehrmacht, not you know, the Waffen-SS. Keep in mind, the Waffen-SS was a multinational force. You're going to see that 99, you know, the Wehrmacht was 99.99999% German. There actually, I did an oral history with Gretel Heinz, who you admire.
Oh, yes, she's such a dear.
Now, her father and mother and two of her siblings were born in Germany immigrated to the United States. Then she was born in the United States, you know, during the Weimar period. Then when the National Socialist came into power, he wanted to go back to Germany. You know, he wanted to go back. So they went back to Germany, stayed in Germany during the war. He was not able, he was a pure-blooded German, but he was not able to serve in the German Wehrmacht because he was stateless. That should give you an idea about how rigid the requirements were to serve. And even when the Germans were losing the war, he could not serve in the Wehrmacht. Instead, he was given a job in a munitions factory, but he could not carry a weapon and wear the Wehrmacht uniform, even though he had been born in Germany, but the fact that he had immigrated but had come back. He was considered a German. They'd given him a job, but the requirements to serve were so rigid. Now, what about these pictures we see, you know, these people wearing these German uniforms that are not obviously not Germans? War makes for interesting bedfellows and interesting coalitions. And that happens. Hitler had an interesting quote during the Russian campaign, and I'm going to paraphrase it because I don't remember the exact quote verbatim, but he remarked that it was fascinating that he had aligned with Japan and was fighting to basically end against the Aryan, you know, white people's domination, and meaning the British, in Asia. He thought that was ironic because you know that he admired England and Britain tremendously, but he thought that was ironic that he was fighting. He had aligned with non-Aryan, non-white people, and was fighting to end the white influence in Asia. War makes for interesting coalitions and interesting bedfellows. There were, no doubt, there's photographic evidence, volunteers and various, I'm going to call them isolated incidences and very limited incidences, where there were non-Germans that wore the uniform, that enlisted, that were sympathetic to the German cause, particularly when it came to the Eastern campaign, and in some cases, against British imperialism, but more so against the Eastern campaign. In one case, the Germans in North Africa, they had helped organize an Egyptian brigade that was going to stay behind German lines and were going to engage in a bunch of behind the lines activities. It never happened. I'm not degrading the Egyptian brigade. The Germans certainly didn't, but they spent a lot of time and effort training this Egyptian brigade. There's video of this brigade being trained by German officers. It just never went anywhere. It's one thing to plan and train for it, but when you're actually comes time to do it, you know, the British were very ruthless. Look at what they did in India. Look at what they did in South Africa. And that was well known around the world. So,
yes.
Why these Egyptian units didn't carry out their sabotage and guerrilla campaigns, that's, you know, known only to them. If they're still alive, they'd be very old men.
Sure.
But anyway, were there? Yes. Was it pervasive? Was it a big thing? Was it, you know, was it a huge in terms of numbers? No, it was not. And this is going to lead me into, you know, the overall demographics and some of the racial policies. Were there some black Germans? Yes. Does that mean the Germans were mixed race? No. If a Austrian marries marries a Prussian, that's not mixed race. Where did these black Germans come from? Well, let's talk about that because it concerns some of the early German academicians. It concerned one very particularly. We're going to talk about him. Let's talk about him now. And we're going to talk about a particular institute. Eugen Fischer was a racial theorist, and he was very concerned. And let's talk about just how many there were. Where did the black Germans come from? They came from two primary let's call them sources. One, it came from the Rhineland. And as you know, Deanna, I just sent you the thing. I just interviewed the grandnephew of the NSDAP Gauleiter of the Rhineland. The Gauleiter's name was Heinz Hacke. His grandnephew is still alive, lives in Spain. He is dedicated to preserving his grand uncle's work. His granduncle wrote, you know, there was three books that were the backbone of National Socialist, what you would call, you know, National Socialism, Mein Kampf, Alfred Rosenberg's book, and Heinz Hacke's book. Mm-hmm. And Michael Hacke, who I interviewed, he is trying to get his granduncle's book reproduced. He has made it available online. I'm going to post it on my website. But anyway, his Heinz Hacke, you know, I just interviewed his granduncle, was the Gauleiter of the Rhineland. The Rhineland, as you know, was occupied by the French mm-hmm. when the Germans were not able to pay their reparations.
Mm-hmm.
Out of spite and meanness, the French sent in French colonial Moroccan black troops
mm-hmm.
into the Rhineland. And there two things happened. There were rapes, and there was some consensual. That cannot be denied. That there was some consensual sexual relations, but there was also rapes. That is the source of some of the Negro Germans, what you call, they were called Rhineland bastards.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon the language, but that's what they were called.
Mm-hmm.
And they were not called that by the NSDAP, because this happened in the Weimar. They were called this by Weimar. They were called this even by some of what you would call the Weimar gentlemen, the Weimar liberals. And so there was the creation of these, what you would call, Weimar bastards. They were not looked favorably upon, whether they were the result of consensual relationships between German women or rapes. But there was one source. The second source of hybrid black Germans, mulattoes, was a result of relationships in German colonies in Africa, mainly German Southwest Africa, which is the present-day Namibia. Now, what's interestingly is in the Rhineland, it was relationships and rapes of black French colonial troops and German women, but Eugen Fischer's research, because he went there, determined in Namibia it was white German. Interestingly, missionaries and German civil service employees, German men, and local black women.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and for the most part, it was almost identical to what was taking place in the Rhineland. It was either, you know, the consensual, or in some cases, it was men forcing themselves, you know, rape.
Sure.
But he was very concerned. Fischer was very concerned about this, and he wrote reports back. And he did this research in 1908. Now, do the math. The NSDAP did not come to power until 1933. He did this before even World War I. But anyway, he wrote several studies and reports. And finally, by 1912, the Kaiser's government forbid interracial relationships in all German colonies as a result of Fischer's memorandums and studies. Fischer's work and research, gained notoriety among the National Socialists, and he wrote many scholarly works. And by the way, he didn't become a party member of the NSDAP until 1940, which is kind of interesting. And he retired from the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, where he did where most of the racial hygiene and anthropological work was performed under the NSDAP. He became a party member in 1940. He retired in 1942. But anyway, Fischer, it was. Fischer's work was the backbone of addressing the situation and the forbidding of miscegenation in Germany prior to the NSDAP. It was illegal. It was illegal under the Kaiser, and the it remained on the books during Weimar, interestingly. Now, this is interesting. Under the Third Reich, Germany's population was 65 million persons. Now, that started dropping during the war. The black population, the mulatto population, according to the highest estimate by the NSDAP government. Now, it's interesting, you know, and of course, they counted the mulatto person counted as a mulatto was, according to the 1935 Nuremberg laws, was 23,000.
Wow. Okay.
Out of 65 million. That's, you know, very, very low. That is not enough to count the Germans as mixed race at that period of time. Hitler had some very strong opinions, and they cannot be denied. And I'm gonna quote what he said, what his position was. Ultimately, he blamed Jews, by the way. But Hitler's position, and he stated this in Mein Kampf, was that the Rhineland bastards, they were basic, they contaminated German blood, they contaminated, quote, he said, they contaminated our race by injecting Negro blood into the Rhineland Germans and into the white peoples in the heart of Europe. He also blamed France, by the way, because he said French society at that time was becoming more and more niggerfied. He went on to blame Jews, and he said that Jews had was in control of the French policies of bringing Negroes into the Rhineland to basically contaminate German blood so as to lower the cultural and political dynamics of German society and European society. You can probably make the case that he was correct. But that was Hitler's position. Now, contrast that with what really happened in the Berlin Olympics in 1936. I'm going to make a case here. Jesse Owens comes to Berlin. He can walk in the front door of a Berlin restaurant. He can sit anywhere he wants. He can sit at a sidewalk cafe. And a recent article just came out, I don't know if you saw it, Deanna, that he kept a picture that Hitler, he had requested a picture from Hitler. Hitler had sent it and provided it, and and Owens had said that he did that because he was treated better in Berlin than he was back home.
Indeed. Well, they were still lynching people in the South at that point in time.
Yeah. Now, what does that tell us? It tells us, and I'm going to go into more detail here, because in addition to Eugen Fischer, we have Fritz Lentz, and then we actually have Alfred Plutz, who was actually coined the term racial hygiene. National Socialist Germany, they weren't racial supremacists by any means. They were an ethno-state. They weren't even contrary to popular myth. They didn't go to the Rhineland and pick up all of those Rhineland bastards that Hitler saw as, you know, a black eye, you know, no pun intended,
right?
And you know, ship them off to, you know, Auschwitz to be gassed, because there wasn't any gas chambers at Auschwitz anyway. But it was an ethno-state. What Hitler was concerned with, and the National Socialists was concerned with, was all through German history, you actually had Germans as a unique people, a unique culture. They had survived the Roman Empire, and of course Hitler saw the Roman Empire, much like he saw the Austro-Hungarian Empire, as this multicultural Weimar-like cesspool, and he didn't want that happening. And a lot of Germans, by the way, agreed with him. A lot of German academicians, a lot of German artists, a lot of Germans in high culture agreed with the National Socialists. We have said, Deanna, on prior shows, that the very first pushback, someone talked about an echo. I'm not hearing an echo, so I don't know where that's coming from.
Yeah, I'm not. I don't hear an echo either.
But anyway, a lot of the initial opposition to Weimar came from organizations like the Thule Society, and other artists and academicians, because you didn't have this, you know, it was all foreign, you know, the fact that you had this absolute decadence, you know, what we call multiculturalism today, that's what was happening under Weimar. And so the National Socialists sought to reverse all of this decadence, and that was the reason why they had all of that initial legislation.
Right. Well, if you're talking about certain hypocrisies, early on, this country had the Black Codes, which prevented Africans from settling in certain areas, or they required fees. The freed slaves were subjected to harsh punishment, such as beatings, property seizures, and monetary fines, all legalized by the white courts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let me cover a couple of more. You had Fritz Lentz, who actually preceded Eugen Fischer as director at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute. But he specialized in hereditary diseases and what he called racial health. That, you know, all of this, you know, to some people, this all may sound, oh, evil, wicked, and dubious. But it was this science, this field of study was widely studied going back to the 1800s all the way up to the war. It was sidelined during World War One. But, you know, World War One, all of these scientists talked about the tremendous negative impact that World War One had on Germany in terms of all the men had been wiped out.
Right.
And Germany and Weimar was importing all of these non-Germans, and obviously the result was a miscegenation, and there would be no more Germans. Now, I don't know, you know, who can disagree with that? We get concerned. I mean, I'm going to use a modern analogy. People raise millions of dollars to preserve the blue whale, or, you know, orcas, whatever.
Sure.
The blue whale. These gentlemen and scholars, as well as the National Socialists, were concerned, you know what, let's preserve us as well. And that doesn't mean we hate the Namibians. And that's what they really were. They weren't
sure.
Germans. They weren't German Southwest Africans. They were Namibians. And by the way, for those listening, Germany to this day maintains a very close relationship to Namibia. They just found an old steamship from 1900 that had been sent down there in pieces, and it was at some dock, and Germany is paying to restore because it's the last of the old Wilhelm era ships, and Germany maintains a relationship with its old colony Namibia. Just a little side note, but they were concerned the fact that they wanted to preserve who and what they were as a unique person. They were Germans. They were Germanic. There was this Nordic element. There were some in this field of study that were absolute Nordicists, and there were some that were just Germanic, and there were some that were right down the middle and said, well, all Germans have some degree of Nordic blood in them, and some do not, and I'm not going to get too much into that. But I want to dispel this issue, one, that, you know, Germans, are they a mixed race? Well, you know, Hitler's first party meeting, as I recall, you know, the German Workers' Party was advocating Bavarian secession. And Hitler opposed Bavarian secession because he said, look, Austrians are Germans, Bavarians are Germans, Prussians are Germans, Rhinelanders are Germans. And he talked about we're Germans. And, you know, so I don't buy into this concept that Germans are mixed race, and I don't buy into the concept that 23,000 mulattoes at the height, and keep in mind, because of the National Socialists were methodical in record keeping, and that's how I know there was no so-called Holocaust, because if there was, they would have recorded it.
Oh, absolutely.
The 23,000 mulattoes constitutes the Germans being mixed race mulatto. It just doesn't wash, but an Austrian marrying a Prussian is not race mixing. That's like saying, you know, it just doesn't wash. They're Germans. And that's why, you know, Hitler had made that deal with Stalin. he wanted the Germans to come home to the Reich. And you had all those, 1940, 1941, you had these huge shipments of Germans coming in even from Russia. And it was fascinating because you had these Germans, and the Germans back in Germany, you were listening to these Germans that were speaking very poor German with Russian, almost Russian. And it's just fascinating. There's books written on the subject. But getting back to this, there were at the height, they said there was 23,000 black, you can call them black Germans. And I'm going to post an article with some photographs on this. How were they treated? Fisher was concerned with them, by the way. Fisher was very staunch. He did not want them procreating. 600 of them, there's records in the German archives, he sterilized 600 of them.
Wow.
That is true. He sterilized 600 of them at the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute.
But I bet he didn't give them syphilis to see how they reacted to that.
I don't think he did. We talked about Mengele and the canard about the medical experiments. That's true. There's no record of that. But 600 out of 23,000, Deanna, and like I said, I'm sitting there. We opened the show saying you have to talk about everything. You put it all on the table. I'm putting it on the table. There's records of him sterilizing 600 out of, and that was his position. That was Fisher's position, was he did not want the German race diluted. He wanted to preserve it. That was his position. And I think we need to keep in mind a modern term has come out called the ethno-state, and I think I covered this earlier in the show. That is what National Socialist Germany was, and we have about 30 minutes left, and I think that's how I want to spend the next 30 minutes, if that's okay, unless
sure.
you have a call.
And I think let me check. Nope, no callers.
Okay. National Socialist Germany was an ethno-state. The National Socialists provided a platform for a lot of these scholars who had been doing work for years, who were concerned about what had happened in Weimar, what had happened. I mean, there were Germans. Let's go back to the Wilhelm era. When Kaiser Wilhelm started reaching out and grabbing colonies in Africa, there were Germans that didn't like that idea because of this, Deanna. They were saying, wait a minute, hold on. Do we really need colonies? Navy, yes. Lots of ships. Navy, yes. Because the Kaiser started building up a fleet that would rival Great Britain. As a matter of fact, the Kaiser's Navy was far superior to the Third Reich's Navy in terms of size, sheer size, surface fleet. But there was Germans that were uncomfortable with the Kaiser reaching into Africa because they were concerned about what would come home. And when those Germans came home, even before they lost the colonies, here came these Germans, and they had these little mulatto offspring, and there was Germans that were concerned about that. I can tell you my German grandmother was very, very had strong opinions, Deanna, about mulatto children. She was the nicest person in the world, but she had very, very strong. She was very nice, very loving, very respectful. I mean, she would never be mean or cruel, but she did not believe that that was the thing to do. She thought it was, she thought the children would encounter trouble later on in life, and that just came from who and what she was at her. That was her generation.
Well, yes, I know of. I had a friend in school who was mixed, and she did have a lot of issues.
Yep.
She did have a lot of. I was her friend, and we talked about this, and it was very difficult for her.
Well, it has to do with identity. Who do they identify with? Because in a lot of cases, neither culture wants them, and so it's cruel. It's absolutely cruel. And mm-hmm. I think that played into these Germans back home that said, these colonies. First of all, colonies are expensive. First of all, they rarely pay for themselves in the long term. Clement Attlee, that was one of the reasons why he ditched, a lot of the British colonies after the war.
Sure.
They don't pay for themselves in a lot of cases. I mean, look at Britain today. You can have a black person with Asian looking eyes speaking a British accent, and who do they identify with? I mean, it's something to study. But anyway, there were Germans that didn't like the concept of having these colonies. And for this reason, they thought it would have a long-term detrimental effect to their Germanhood. And so some of these scholars, including, you know, people like Fisher, really advocated, you know, banning miscegenation. And he was successful. Keep in mind, in 1912, the Kaiser's government banned miscegenation, and these laws stayed on the, you know, stayed on the books.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you have the French colonial troops in the Rhine. And why did that happen in the Rhine? Well, we talked about rape. And then you had a situation, the German laws were not in effect. Germany, Weimar, German government could not enforce any laws under French occupation in the Rhine.
Right.
And so when the French pulls out, you have some of these, you know, women giving birth. In some cases, they were very candid that, you know, they had been raped. And in other cases, you know, it was consensual. And so you have these Germans, you know, hybrid children. And I can't remember the total number that were recorded as being born in the Rhineland.
Mm-hmm.
So you have another crop. You have the ones that have come back from Namibia, and then you have the new ones that were born, and they were called the Rhineland bastards. And there was special legislation, by the way, in 1935 and 1936, all of the Rhineland bastards. And I'm using that term because that is what they were – the legislation required the registration – of the Rhineland bastards, and they were forbidden when the Nuremberg laws were amended in November of 1935 or 1936. The Rhineland bastards were forbidden to marry the pureblood. I'll just call them what, you know, that's mm-hmm. a better term. They were forbidden. They could not procreate with the pureblood German girls. Now, did it happen? Probably so. I mean, let's understand human biology. Did it happen? Probably so. You know,
and this is not just, this is not to say that one race is superior. This is just to say, okay, keep the races separate. I mean, that's the way it was set up.
That is what National Socialist Germany practiced. And I've used Jesse Owens as an example. Jesse Owens shows up to Berlin. He didn't even have a functional pair of tennis shoes. He got his tennis shoes from the German team captain. I mean, let's understand that. And so, you know, when I'm talking about some of the things I'm dispelling on this show, I don't disagree with some of the things that have been said previously, but I think we should put it in perspective. Were Germans mixed race? No. Were they an ethno-state? Yes. Were they fervent about it? Absolutely, because, Deanna, I've interviewed Germans that lived in the Third Reich. Some of them were, you know, it was like that, and I really didn't care. And some of them that I've interviewed were very supportive of it and miss that part of it because they deeply believe that Germany is going away, that there will be no Germans fairly soon. And I think that there is I agree with them. I mean, it's if you look at what's happening to modern Germany with the influx of Turks and some of the, you know, Somalis and all of that, I think there's a case to be made. And culturally, I think Germany is gone. I mean, it's just really – it's gone what's happened to them. But, you know, there's a couple of operative quotes, you know, that Hitler said, and they don't count. Nothing that the Germans said in terms of their racial policy classifies them as as haters, as what is – as they're being portrayed. There's nothing bad or hateful about implementing an ethno-state. Here is none other, you know, Field Marshal Albert Kesselring is hardly one that you would think. Now, he was a Luftwaffe field marshal, and he was the last, you know, he was the commander when Hitler, at the last days of the Reich in 1945, he appointed Kesselring the commander in the south and Dönitz the commander in the north when the Soviets and the Americans severed the Reich at the Elbe. But this is a quote from Kesselring not during the Third Reich. This is Kesselring in 1953. And I'll quote it. It's just one sentence. There are many things we can alter. We can adapt ourselves to progress and learn new and valuable lessons, but let us keep our character and respect our traditions. Let us beware of becoming a people without roots. You know, now that's a very coy statement because he said it in 1953 in a denazification, you know, in a denazified Germany.
Mm-hmm.
he's pretty clear what he's saying.
Well, I think you have to also keep in mind who is behind multicultural mentality, and you can see this the same thing happening here in this country. And when you were talking about the Germans coming back from the war, I'm comparing the war in the Middle East, and the men who are coming back from the war are told by the VA not to have children because they may be born deformed and all kinds of things. And then we see the influx of people from Mexico and from South America and whatnot, and it's the same thing. You're taking, you know, one group of men and kind of marginalizing them and replacing them with other men. I think it's all pretty deliberate.
Oh, sure. Sure. You know, and we talk about, I like looking at original documents, original. And the National Socialists published a lot of materials right up until 43, probably early January 44. Then the publishing kind of tapered off.
Mm-hmm.
But they published a document on racial theory and mate selection. Now, marriage was very important to them. They really believed in marriage and having children. Well, there is a document called Racial Theory and Mate Selection. And they want you to pick, you know, the young people to pick the right thing. Well, in one section, they talk about dangers of interracial breeding. Now, if Germany was a mixed-race country, I don't think they would have that in there at all.
Ah.
And I'll just read two sentences
in
here because it's funny. It's kind of entertaining. It says, the irrational animal only joins with members of the same race for procreation. People close to nature, like the Germans, the farmer who is rooted in the soil and close to the earth, who feels the call of blood and race, acted from the same instinct over many generations. Only the overly rational cultured person believes that he can act against nature. Sounds like they're talking about the liberals. It says, mixed breeds are physically and psychologically disharmonious. You know, they go on. I mean, they left us a huge body of work, but we can go on and talk about, you know, Hitler himself was very, very, he said in a speech in 1938, we cannot permit an alien race to impose itself upon our working people as their leaders. Now, he was talking about Jews there.
Right.
Very clear. But then there was another an interesting book. It was called Faith in Action. And this was a little pamphlet, and I have a copy of it, a translated copy. And there's two lines in it that was very important. And this was a book provided to the Hitler Youth. And the very first edition was in 1938. The last printing was in 1943. Like I said, the printing tapered off because of the war effort. But it had like about 12 different sections: blood, race, people, state. But in the first two sections was blood and race. And I want to read two lines out of it. It gives you an idea. And like I said, my position here is, one, Germans were not mixed race. They were not by any means multicultural. I will stipulate that there was non-Germans that served in the war effort, but that was predominantly there was very few, and that was from 1941 on. Anyway, and we'll talk about the Waffen-SS in the last few minutes. But here in this section, blood, just two lines from the section on blood. There's only a paragraph in that section. You carry in your blood the holy inheritance of your fathers and forefathers. And by the way, nowhere in this book does it tell these young Hitler youth, go out and genocide everybody that's not like you. Go out and, you know, run a gas chamber. It's fun on weekends.
Sure.
Nowhere does it tell that. As a matter of fact, it says that everybody should respect one another as being unique and different. You know, let me digress here a little bit. The Germans, under national, and they still are, by the way, to their credit, the Germans were great trading partners all around the world. They had great trading and cultural exchanges in Latin America, in the Balkans, you know, among Slavic countries. And there were some of these scholars that I've quoted that were anti-Slav. I'll touch on that if we have enough time. There was philosophical disagreements. There were some of these racial scholars that were strictly Nordicist, that thought Slavs were, you know, going to endanger the Western European cultures. But on the other side, there was others that weren't so worried about it. But in nowhere in this, in any of these writings, are they telling, particularly ones geared towards the youth, run out and engage in genocide, go out and wipe everybody else off, go out and enslave the world. It was basically, like I said, it was building an ethno-state and being pride of who and what you are and preserving who and what you are. And that is fundamentally different than the message that is put forth by Hollywood, that what took place in Germany between 1933 and 1945 was just one big hate fest.
Right.
It's just not accurate. It's just not accurate. But let me finish reading this. This is fascinating. You carry in your blood the holy inheritance of your fathers and forefathers. That is true. To deny your blood is to deny yourself. Now, you know what's interesting about that statement is if you go on YouTube, Deanna, and I think your listeners and people in the chat room will agree, you can go on YouTube now and find young white kids that will talk about opining about how they hate themselves because they're white that you know, and that they're so guilty. And that is, I think, the Jew triumphant.
Yes.
But if you get a young white kid that – and I think anybody that makes a video talks about how pride you know, they are, you know, taking pride in who and what they are, I think that's great. But when I see somebody going on and making a video, and it's always young white kids that I see doing this, talking about how ashamed they are and who and what they are and that they're ashamed of their privilege. I like to know what privilege that is, by the way. I think that is an absolute travesty, and it goes to show you the power of this Jewish media, and it gives you an idea. That is what Weimar was doing to the Germans and what the National Socialists overturned. And the next section on race, this was the important part. He who mixes his blood with that of foreign races ruins the blood and soul that have been given to him to pass on in purity to his children. Purity to his children. Now, if Germans were mixed race, I don't think they would be putting that in there.
Right.
He makes his children impure and miserable and commits the greatest crime that he can commit. But he who follows the laws of race fulfills the greatest commitment that only should be brought together with like and keeping apart those things like fire and water which do not mix.
Sure.
Now that's not again. You know that sounds that's hate. You know that's horrible. That's horrible. Well. No, this was written in this was a reprint. This is a 1943 reprint of a 1938 document. And again, this was built upon the fact that you had World War I that had wiped out, you know, a couple generations worth of young men. You had a Weimar cultural Marxist government that was importing non-Germans. And you're saying, you know, this isn't good, you know, we're going to be gone. It's almost like I'll use the analogy right now in the Native American, the Redmond communities all around the United States. They have a legitimate concern that their young people are assimilating to Mexican culture and learning Spanish instead of knowing their own culture and knowing their own language.
Exactly.
That's a legitimate concern. That is a legitimate concern. And so you have these scholars that were writing articles, such as Fisher, such as these other, saying, you know what, you know, we need to think about, are there going to be any Germans in the year 2014? I'm using the date 2014. I think they were talking about the year 2000. They were talking about, because Goebbels would later write a speech, famous Germany in the year 2000. Talking about Germany in the year 2000 was a common theme. Several German scholars talked about Germany in 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had a legitimate concern. There was, let's see some of my other notes that I have here. It was doing pretty good time-wise. They look at what we have missed.
Just as a side note, in 1979, the Indian tribes in this country made it a federal law, and they wanted a federal law that white people could not adopt Indian children because they wanted to maintain their race integrity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, I don't have a problem with that.
No.
I don't have a problem, but I just wish if we're going to pass, if we're going to codify in the law race laws for some, then we should, then they should be race laws for everybody.
Sure.
And you know, turnabout is fair play, and for the United States government, which is dominated, like I said in press TV yesterday, by Jews,
mm-hmm.
then and we should demand there should be no problem with us saying, you know what, for a Native American and red man or a Mexican or somebody stand up and say that policy is not good for my people, fine. But we should not be afraid to stand up and say that policy is not good for our people, because there's a lot of policies that are horrific for our people.
Right.
I mean, it's just absolutely horrific. There's nothing wrong with that, because when push comes to shove, all politics, when you have a country like the United States, which is no different than Yugoslavia or the Soviet Union, United States, Soviet Union, and Yugoslavia are all multiracial, artificial unions in which multiracial people are forced together at the point of a gun, and at any given time somebody is told that, you know, you're on the short end, and right now we're on the short end because the Jews are in charge, then it's time for people to advocate. And how do people advocate in those, what is the basis of policy in those types of artificial unions? It has to do with your racial interest. It has to do with your tribal interest. It has
mm-hmm.
to do with group interest. What is good for your people? On a more local level, what is good for my family in my city? If they're going to be messing with the zoning in my town, it's what's good for my family, what's good for my house. And, you know, we need to think about it in those terms and in those terms. And that is what, if you go back and look at what, you know, the fundamental issue with, you know, with Hitler, the National Socialist, the Versailles Treaty was incredibly hostile and unfair to the German tribe, to the Germans.
Absolutely.
That is what Hitler did. He advocated on behalf of the Germans. Now, I think the case can be made that as the National Socialists and the Germans became immensely successful, they became advocates for Europeans. I think that evolved. I think there was a natural evolution. Now, there will be people that will disagree with me on that, and I would love to debate that issue, because I think the case can be made that the National Socialist, Hitler, evolved, because there were times when he talked about it wasn't just for Germans. He talked about Europe.
For the whole of Europe. Absolutely.
That's right, because he talked about the, you know, case against the Jewish Bolshevik Asiatic sweeping into Europe. I think the case can be made that he secured Germany, and it became more than just about Germany. And there are people, I think, that will disagree with me about that, but that's fine. You know, I think honest disagreement based on intellectual honesty is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the case can be made that's what happened. Are there any callers?
Let me just look. No, there's no callers.
Okay. Well,
if you would like to ask a question, the telephone number is 646-787-1915. I'm sorry I didn't get that out previously. Maybe that's why there's no callers.
We have
a private number.
I think there's one other item, and we have, 10 minutes, Deanna,
yes.
to cover on the list, and that is the economics of the Third Reich. I heard a comment that there was Bank of England loans, and I wanted to address that, because you might remember I had some back and forth with, I think he was a Dutch economist, Anthony Michaels, and I was supposed to debate him, but he did not make himself available, so I just did some sideshows and some rebuttals. And I wanted to address that, because the comment that I heard was that there was Bank of England loans, and I wanted to I would be curious. There were no Bank of England loans between 1933 and 1940. You know, there wouldn't have been Bank of England loans after 1939. But I covered this. There just wouldn't have been. You know, there wouldn't have been. But I would be curious if someone thinks that the, you know, Jewish Bank of England was somehow making loans to National Socialist Germany after Hitler came to power. I'd be curious to see copies of those notes and what the terms were, because, Hjalmar Schacht was for a period of time, you know, the finance minister and was the Reichsbank president, but he went away, shipped off after a while, and he served his purpose, and his sole purpose was to maintain some limited some credibility for the time being and to renegotiate the existing loan. Keep in mind, Weimar hawked Germany and created artificial prosperity in 1924-1925, and they did it by borrowing from the United States, borrowed a tremendous amount. They hawked Germany's railway and some of its natural resources, and so and by the way, Schacht was involved in that.
Yes, he was.
And so anyway, he was retained for a period of time. And he was eventually, and let's also remember that when the National Socialists took over, they just didn't walk in the doors of government. They did get rid of the Jews when they passed the Civil Service Act in 1933, but they didn't get rid of all of the Weimar people initially. They phased them out. There was a period of time after President von Hindenburg died where they kind of restructured everything, but about 80% of the Weimar bureaucracy remained. You have to run the government. And but Schacht remained, and what did he do was he restructured some of the reparations issues and some of the, more importantly, the existing loans. But there wasn't any new loans. That was something that the National Socialists had issues with. How the National Socialists functioned, and again, this is on, and it's on my website, and I'll send you the link, Deanna, where I did this in-depth interview with Jason Erb. Where I addressed Michael's issue. I remember one of Anthony Michael's claims was, oh, yeah, there was lots of usury, but I can't find any source to substantiate that, and I can't find any source to say what the rate was.
Sure.
And what I outlined was there was issues. The National Socialists inherited the debt from Weimar.
Exactly.
That debt was restructured. They did not take on any additional debt after they came to power in January 1933 to fund, like, the port. You know, they created full employment. They did two things. They engaged in new port improvements, the port at Bremen and Hamburg. They renovated the port improvements. They did new reclamation projects, the Autobahn. People think of the Autobahn as the big public works project. That was only one of them.
Right.
There was also the port projects in Bremen and Hamburg. There was reclamation projects because one of the Germany National Socialists received tremendous support from farmers, and they brought more land into cultivation by reclamation and bringing more land into crop production. They did that. Now, how did they do that? They did that by what was called the labor bond. They basically mortgaged. They raised revenue based on the value of labor.
Right.
And so. There wasn't. That didn't come from the Bank of England because there's no interest on a labor bond. And the Bank of England, a couple of things. The Bank of England was fervently opposed to the National Socialists. The Bank of England was behind the Jewish boycott, so they weren't going to dole out any cash. The bank, while Hjalmar Schacht went to Washington to renegotiate some of the loans, there's a famous picture of Hjalmar Schacht on Capitol Hill and at the White House. The Bank of England was actually trying to undermine what Schacht was doing in Washington, D.C. Interestingly, in a very rare move, Washington disregarded the Bank of England and went ahead and did the renegotiation, which is kind of strange, but they did it. Because, you know, an American, they have a concept. You know, if we don't sign this, we might not get our money. We do want to get our money. So in a rare form, they disregarded that. But anyway, I don't know where this concept was. You know, I addressed it with Anthony Michaels, but what I'm trying to understand is anybody that thinks the Bank of England was funding National Socialist Germany, I'd like to see the source for it. I'd like to understand. I'd like to see copies of the notes because you'd see that all of the Weimar notes, you can actually get copies. They're in archives. For instance, there was about a year ago or 2 years ago, there was great fanfare that Germany had finally paid off the World War One reparations, and they had posted the actual documents, the old archive documents.
Even England hasn't done that.
Well, England, what can I say about England?
There is a question from the chat room. David Irving, in a video on YouTube, refers to Hitler being funded by what would be considered surprising quarters, but he only suggests that they were Jews. So what are your comments on that?
Well, I have some philosophical disagreements with David Irving. I'm
Me
not going to come on radio, but David Irving has become famous. Keep in mind, David Irving also comes he just had his visa changed, so I don't know if he's going to be coming back to the United States. But he has been famous for coming to the United States and, you know, having his book events, and then he turns around and says we shouldn't be gun nuts and should be willing to give up our Second Amendment rights. So I have some issues. That's a separate question. But was Adolf Hitler funded by Jews? No. Absolutely not. Did he receive funding from all quarters of Germany? Yes. That included industrialists, including one Emil Kirchdorf, and that is something. Veronica Clark wrote an excellent essay on funding of Hitler, but she did leave out, I think, the importance of Emil Kirchdorf, and let me just bring that up really quick. Emil Kirchdorf was one of the first, if not the first, recipient of the Order of the German Eagle, beautiful medallion awarded to him by Hitler personally. Emil Kirchdorf died just a few months, I believe, within a year of receiving that. Hitler was not well off financially when he came out of Landsberg prison. Quite the opposite. He was hurting for money, and he was forbidden to speak. And, you know, some of his speeches were being distributed on Deutsche Grammophon vinyl records. Anyway, Kirchdorf was a believer. He saw potential in Hitler, and he actually put a fund together which included 100,000 Reichsmarks of his own money and supported Hitler. That is not an illegal slush fund. Some people will use the analogy, much like the famous Checker speech that Richard Nixon gave, where he had a fund put together by a rich California businessman. Similar, yes, but not illegal. Is it illegal or immoral for supporters to put together a fund when you're down and out, politician is down and out, while you're waiting for your book to be public? No, it is not. But I think it's important to be accurate. The National Socialist Party, you know, had highs and lows. Let's understand that. It had highs and lows. It costs money to run election after election after election in a parliamentary system. And by the way, there was a famous quote by Joseph Goebbels because of what was happening in the Weimar system. He says, man, we don't break out fairly soon and get into power, we're going to basically win ourselves to death, because they were winning elections, but Hindenburg was a little resistance, putting Hitler in as chancellor. There was a lot of dynamics going on. So was Hitler supported by Jews? No. Could a Jew have gone to the ballot box and voted for Hitler? Who knows? There's some psychotic Jews. I don't know. But did he get a bunch of secret slush money from Jews? No. Did Hitler get money from various different sources, including German industrialists? That is true. Mm-hmm. That is true. And was it illegal or shady?
No.
Was Hitler a tax cheat? No. Was von Hindenburg a tax cheat? No.
Oh, my goodness. We only have 90 seconds.
That was a good way to end the show, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Oh, it's been wonderful. It's always wonderful to have you on the program.
Well, I'm glad I got to be number one.
Yes, I'm so excited to be back, and perhaps I'll add more days, because it is according to the package, a Monday through Friday situation. But anyway, it's been wonderful having you on the program, and we are going to have to do this again. So thank you, listeners, for joining us today. And thank you, Rodney, for presenting so much great, great information. So,
and I want to again say sorry to George for just glancing at that quote. But I've been getting a lot of interesting emails recently.
He understands. All righty. Thank you so much, listeners. And we will talk with you next week. Thank you.